Welcome back. It's Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're about to hear the latest installment from our World of the Play series, a series we do that looks at the issues that are inspired by the plays that we hear and see at Everyman Theater. This time, we're talking about Arthur Miller's play, Death of a Salesman, and explore what the American dream means in the 21st century. Welcome to A Dream Deferred as we look at what we think comes out of this play and what that American dream means. And it's good to have you all here. We're going to start tonight with a Passover Seder. Just kidding. we all get four questions. So let me introduce our panel first before we jump right into this. Alethea Hunjinshin is at the very end of the row here. She's come actually through three cultures, Korea, Canadian, American. She has a Master of Fine Arts degree in Community Arts from the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's both an artist, and she's exploring the identity of Greek diaspora and that community arts program at Mikey. It's one of the most unique programs in the country, and I'm glad she's with us today. And next to her is Jadzia Floyd, who is 19 years old, born and raised here, a co-founder and graduate of the Baltimore Youth Initiative Project. She is a youth artist that has been working on these issues of justice and has been really passionate around the issues that she's been fighting for all of her life, around race and gender and sexism and more. And I've also known her since she was born, I guess. So it's good to have her on this panel with us. Brother Changa Nyongo is with us. He's a musician, father of six children, and is an artist in our community, executive director of the Community Mediation Project, and also founding director of Our Boys Institute, one of our kind of more important people in this community who wrestles with, really does help people resolve issues that they face all through the city. And next to me is Jeff Singer. He's been a community organizer and a social worker for 40, 50 years almost, a long time. And is the founder of Healthcare for the Homeless. And I say that he's a very humble guy. He really is. But what he founded was one of the most powerful, unique institutions in our community. And I always tease him, and we've known each other for a long time, that anybody with his politics and looks like he does can build something like that. That's amazing. But he did it and built this incredible institution. Brick and mortar as well, that really does serve human beings in our community. So let's begin. So A Dream Preferred. We were talking before we started today just about what this American dream means and how different it can be depending on who we are and where we come from, our generation, our culture, how we were raised, what it means, even though it's been in the soul of America, that we have this right to pursue happiness and whatever we want, whatever that means at different points in our history. But I'd like to start with Jeff Singer. Is that all right, Jeff? Just because what we were talking about in the back, I think to set up what you were setting up for us, just in terms of where the play comes from, the time it was in and what that means before we kind of spring out into all the kind of different diverse ways we can interpret this.
Sure, we can do that, Mark. And Milani, we should thank Milani Douglas for having organized
this. This panel is Milani's creation.
Yes, Mark has given me a charge, I guess, of providing a little context for the play. You know, the play was written in 1948, first performed in 1949. Every year of American history is a signal year. 1948 and 49. Especially, though, because you all will remember, some of you may remember, there's a presidential election in 1948, and Harry Truman is running on essentially a civil rights platform. There's been a lot of racial tension during World War II, and before and after, but it was particularly sharp right after World War II, and Truman wanted to create some new opportunities for African Americans, like to desegregate the armed forces and government service. So he's running on this platform in 1948. The Southern members of the Democratic Party the overt racists, they're all racist, but the overt racists decide to desert the Democratic Party and create the Dixiecrat Party, and Strom Thurmond, one of the most famous racists in American history, is running for president against Harry Truman and Thomas Dewey, the Republican. And Truman just barely wins this election. In fact, the newspapers, you might recall, advertised the day after the election that Dewey had won. But in any event, so this is going on at the same time that Paul Robeson, you may remember Paul Robeson, one of the great Americans who's a civil rights activist, a political thinker, an actor, an athlete. Paul Robeson's being hauled in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee for being a communist. And to counter that, the committee calls Jackie Robinson to testify against Paul Robeson. Jackie Robinson, a man of great dignity, he was not a political radical, but he refused to besmirch Paul Robeson. And in fact said to the committee, just because this guy might be a communist doesn't mean that what he's saying is wrong. There really is racism and we have to deal with it. So the steel workers are on strike at this time and the government's going to take over the steel industry. There's a lot of social unrest in 1948 and 49. And here comes this meditation on the American dream, this shifting, powerful, and hard-to-define American dream by this Jewish playwright who overtly writes a play that's not Jewish. I'll stop.
It's fine. So I think that, and it's built on this premise, I think, of the American dream, which has to do with our right to have what we want to make us happy, which means money and position and status, which is part of what we think we need to have as Americans, all of us, right? And it, and you were talking backstage, about the how different it's interpreted differently depending on who you are and where you come from. Doesn't have the same meaning across the board.
And when you are.
And pull the mic up so we can.
Yeah. So interpreted very differently across time, right? Across social spectrum. And I would even take issue with the idea of status as a thing. It's not really status that we're looking for. It's more prestige, right? Like if we're really transparent about it. So I'll just back up and I'll just say, for me, American dream is about freedom, right? And it, what freedom is has changed for me. So from 19-year-old me to 25 to 35-year-old me, what is freedom has changed. And in the play, one of the sons is saying, you know, I found freedom. You know, it looks nothing like what you are thinking, Dad. It looks like, you know, dirty hands and this wildness. But then, and in this version of the play, they don't play that up a whole lot, because they flip right back to, he says, but I find myself back here, right? This is what the son says, right? The so-called wayward son. He says, I find myself right back here. Because of you, because I'm trying to impress you, because I'm trying to. And so for me, looking at that, there is this father up there, if you will, right? Who his expectation is what we're living out day to day, all of us, right? Or her, you know, mother, big mother, you know, grandmother, whoever it is, right? Their expectation is what we're living out. And that's what's been pulling us along. But then there's this other voice in there, right? And depending on where you are in your life and your understanding, how much you've read, how much you've been exposed to different experiences over time, your idea of what freedom really is and what it really means, and of course, the pathway to get there, it's just changes, you know? And then the other kind of interesting take on that is that if you have a relationship with anyone, right, be it your significant other or your boss, and it's been over a long time, right? So the first thing that attracted you to have a good relationship with that person was these things, you know. But as 10 years go past, right, you're somebody different. And we have to assume that if you're somebody different, they're somebody different, right? And so when you get to 20 years and 30 years down, this person has changed. 3 and 4 major changes, and you have been making this implicit agreement over and over again to choose to continue to be with that person. And I think we have that kind of relationship with the American dream. As America in our own eyes and mind has changed and become something, you know, sometimes something uglier than what we had anticipated, but we're still making this choice to be engaged with her and hold her in high esteem.
So how did what you just saw in the play and which this conversation about the American dream, I mean, how does it play out for people not yet 30? I mean, how different is it when our perceptions of what this means? How do you play with that? And both of you come from different, coming at it from different places. Alethea, go ahead.
I think I'm 28 right now. And I think I'm at a place where I am making those decisions, I think. And I mean decisions by becoming, I entered my first kind of professional career and as an artist. And I'm at a place where my practice is going to speak, my accent's going to speak. Not that age matters in terms of what you're saying through your actions. But as a community artist, I'm just at a place where everything I do in terms of creating my art or events, I want it to have a message. And in terms of thinking about the American dream, or I'm not American, but I am participating in this community, and I think a lot about that. And I think the history of migration and immigration is long, and a lot of institutions in Baltimore brings a very diverse group of people, and I'm part of that. And I think my time in Baltimore have taught me that, and I think my time here, I've been here for 4 years, and my work is with many of the Korean immigrant communities here, and their history really taught me about what it took for them to survive in Baltimore. A lot of them do jobs in corner stores. A lot of them are in corner stores, public markets. And I think coming from a younger generation is reflecting on the history and understanding that what they have done to nurture our generation, there's something to celebrate about it, and also reflect on why they had to choose those businesses, why they were doing that for, and being able to have the education I have, the privilege I have, kind of comes from those many sacrifices and history. And as a younger person, I feel the responsibility to know that history, and also take what I know and look into the future as a leader in my generation. What do I do? And personally for me as artist, what do I produce in terms of as a cultural producer?
Jensia.
Sure. So, I guess for me, I'm 19. And for me, kind of, when I think about the American dream, I think of, like, finishing high school and going to college, getting, like, starting a career, and, like, buying a house and having a family and, like, the 2.2 kids or whatever and white picket fence. And it's funny, we were talking about this backstage, and everyone's kind of giving their, like, description of what they perceive to be the American dream. And, like, for me, specifically, like, having, like, a minority status, like, I'm Black and female. Well, female's not a minority. But I know, like, having kind of, like, that identity with a lack of privilege, I'm already, like, I'm already not the standard of what an American is perceived to be. So, like, I guess I kind of look at the idea of the American dream kind of from the outside as something that's not really for me, that wasn't really created for me. So, like, as I, like, live my life and, like, make life decisions, following that path or, like, trying to achieve that goal doesn't really apply to me. I guess it's interesting, like, growing up, like, now, like, I just finished high school last year. I'm pretty young and inexperienced. But I just, like, living today, it's really difficult. I guess it's difficult to kind of imagine, like, realistically imagine yourself achieving those standard goals. Because, like, you know, I know, like, some of my friends didn't finish high school. Some of them aren't planning to go to college. Like, I took a year off from college. Like, who does that? Like, are you actually going to go to school? Are you going to have a career? Are you just going to, like, become a crack whore? Like, you know, like, I'm already, like, off the track. So I guess for me, it's not, like, I don't really strive to achieve that American goal.
One of the things I was thinking about was that part of the American dream is built around the notion of the Declaration of Independence, of the pursuit of happiness, right? So this is a document written by white men of property in the late 1700s. And clearly that pursuit broadened the debate over Tubman versus Jackson on the $20 bill and how Jackson created a popular democracy so all white men with or without property had a voice, right? So, and that pursuit of happiness. So, A, what does that pursuit of happiness mean? How did it affect Willie Loman and anybody else on this planet? And does that define differently depending on who you are and where you come from? If you're black, if you're Asian, if you're an immigrant, if you're white, does it make a difference?
I guess I think it does make a difference because, like, I kind of think about kind of, like, the history of our country a lot because I'm really passionate about, like, racism and, like, getting rid of it because who wants that? But especially, like, when people, like, with, like, I guess, like, political races and, like, talking about, like, police reform and stuff like that. Or, like, whenever, like, anyone kind of talks about, like, issues in our country, like, I sometimes, like, say, like, you remember that, like, this country, like, or, like, our political system is based on a system where it was okay to own a human. Like, you remember that, right? Like, there's been, like, edits and changes and, like, facelifts, but it's based on a time where you could own a human. So, like, I think having that kind of history with our country, like, a lot of, like, our systems, our ideals, our dreams, our expectations are based on a time that is very much outdated. So over the years, it becomes less and less relevant to really aspire to those rigid ideals. I think it really does make a big difference, especially for people who don't fit that original person who I just, like, all the privileges were built for. Like, you can still work to get them. Like, I can, like I can go to college, like, I can own land, I can do all these things if I try really hard, but, like, there's still, like, so many disadvantages, you know, or, like, the system wasn't designed for us. The, like, ideals aren't designed in mind of us. So, I don't know.
So then this idea of pursuit of happiness that I think fuels this notion of the American dream. So is it real?
Right.
Does it make a difference? How do we define it now?
Right.
You know, what does it mean?
Does anybody in office can say that, an audience can say that they are truly happy? Like, okay, good, great. And I think that if we polled everyone, they would say this is probably the same four or five basic things, right? You know, the people around me I love are healthy and alive. You know, I don't have this daily struggle. You know, I don't have any kind of perceptible drag on me that makes it dreadful when I wake up, right? You know, that dread that's in, you know, that I didn't do my homework and it's due in the morning, that dread. I remember that dread, right? But we don't have that. We don't live with that dread every day. And so we would consider that happy. You know, those are, and I guarantee if we did a poll and we kind of boiled it down, there would be you know, four or five things that we all kind of agree that equal happy. But in our secret place, in our heart of hearts, when we said the pursuit of happiness, right, there's a voice that's not our own that's helping us, or that's pointing to this is happiness, this is happiness. And it comes from, it, because humans learn by repetition. We know that, right? And so we've heard messages over and over and over and over and over and over about what happiness is. And so just, you know, going back to the play and this idea of, well, what is happiness? And why can't it look like that for that guy? And why can't it look like this for this guy? And if you, right, Willie, understand that after 40 years he was working, right? However many years it was, some ridiculous amount of decades that he was working in this system here, getting consistently less bang for every day that he went out to try and do his business. Why can't you make this shift here to say, this is not, I'm miserable. This is not what's going to get it, right? And the reason is because there's a pressure, right? So we all suffer from this idea that somebody else is controlling, to some degree, what happiness means for us. There's these other voices. There's these other inputs that have been happening since here that tell us what happiness really is. And sometimes it works because, you know, mother might know best, and it might be that she's pushing you in a way that you were meant to wash windows for. So you are blissfully happy, right? But if she's pushing you to be a doctor and you were meant to wash windows, you might wonder why, you know, when you're in there with all those drugs or whatever, you're thinking about downing some of them, you know, because you're, it's a miserable time, no matter what. Even if you have so-called success or what should equal happiness for one person, if it's not you, if it's not for you, this is where it intersects with the conversation about race. Because if I'm not made to fit into this system, you know, that wasn't built for me, but my mother or my grandmother or my whoever is pushing me, no, you got to do this, you got to go to college and you got to do that, I may become Ben Carson, you know, I may be a neuroscientist or whoever, but that doesn't automatically equal happiness.
So just play with this for a minute. Happiness and the dream and what we all pursue. But mm-hmm. I'm going to come back to Jeff, but Alethea, so from your perspective, from your culture's perspective, the Korean culture part of your perspective, what does happiness mean? Is that part of... How would you define that? How would when people from Korea would see the Americans say your pursuit of happiness, what does that mean?
I think it's success. My father was a pastor, but in Korea, to be a pastor or be credible, I think. I think. They appreciate, or having a education from abroad is a plus, and that's how my parents moved for the first time for my dad to finish his degree. And I think also, and that since that move, it influenced me where I didn't quite fit into the Korean system anymore in terms of my education. So I guess going back to success, education was always a big thing in my family, and success meant financially stable. To either whatever you do, just being able to build yourself up so that you can take care of yourself. And I think, but for me, it's been kind of a journey, sort of like Biff, like finding my place of what I was passionate about, and believing in that was the hard part, mm-hmm. I think. And it took a leap of faith to know that this was the right thing for me. And my parents, it took some conversations, but I think it definitely wasn't the traditional path of what we imagined our life would be. But yeah, I think for them, for my parents, it turned into what I believed in, and what I was passionate about was how they found success. And it was a work for both of us, for me to accept the consequences, but what it takes to be, to do what I want to do as a community artist. And then my parents also seeing that what the process is to become the person I want to be. So it was learning from both sides and, talking about it and understanding why I am taking the path that I am, and the process requires this. And the process isn't about getting that A+, or it's not about winning this award or fellowship. It was just really taking everything that came into my life and making something meaningful, and knowing that who I am as a person and what it made me to be.
You're listening to the latest installment from our World of the Play series, where we look at issues behind the plays at Everyman Theater. Today we're discussing Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller, and looking at what the American dream really means. What is that preferred dream in this 21st century? Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. This hour, we're listening to the latest installment in our series, The World of the Play, where we take a closer look at some of the issues that are raised on the plays that appear at Everyman Theater. The play at the moment is Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, and we examine what do we mean by the American dream. Is it preferred? Is it delayed? How does it fit into this 21st century? How does it cross all the racial and cultural boundaries that exist in this nation? Our guests are Alethea Hun Jin Shin, an artist in Baltimore who just got her Master of Community Arts from MICA. Ako Brothachenga Anyango, Baltimore-born musician, carpenter, father of six children, who serves as the executive director of community mediation and co-founder of our Boys Institute. Jeff Singer, community organizer, clinical social worker, public policy advocate, professor, and former executive director and founder of Healthcare for the Homeless. And Jadzia Floyd, a 19-year-old Baltimorean and co-founder and graduate of the Baltimore Youth Initiative High School. Let's get back to that conversation.
In some ways, Jeff, I was thinking that this idea of happiness, coming back to the heart and soul where we are here with this play and the American dream, is almost like a trick bag we put ourselves in, right? This happiness piece. I mean, growing up for me, growing up in a Jewish world, that was very clear. Happiness has nothing to do with it. You know, right. I mean, the joke always was. This is a joke. Valerie and I were driving somewhere. It was long distance, and she said, "You're having fun?" I said, "Yeah, it's all right." Driving away for like we had a 700-mile trip. She said, "But you said you love driving." And I said, "Yeah, I like driving. I like it." So she said, "Aren't you happy?" I said, "Saying that's Jewish for happy. You know, just I like it. It's fine." So I mean, it's like that happiness thing. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, you know, it's because you're not. There's always been this wrestling about why the founding fathers of America put that in there and what they really meant in the 18th century about happiness.
Yeah, I certainly can't tell you exactly what they meant. However, you say trick bag, happiness is like a trick bag. Well, let me put it this way. The American dream is perhaps one of the tools of cultural hegemony. In a capitalist system, there are a small number of people who have real power and a large number of people who don't. And how do we prevent the large number of people who don't have real power from not pursuing some power, right? From not pursuing a world in which everyone could be fulfilled and happy rather than a very small number of people being fulfilled and happy and everyone else working for them, right? Well, one way to do that, inherent to capitalism, is to create this ideology of values. Values like happiness equals a single person striving to get as much out of the world as possible. That's part of happiness. And there are cultures in which that single person striving isn't thought to be the summation of what happiness should be. Maybe there's a group. Maybe there's a collective. Maybe there's a cooperative. Maybe we could all pursue a better society together. Now, Willie Loman never does. And I think purposefully, you know, Arthur Miller being a leftist of some sort, I think he was telling us that part of Willie's unhappiness is he's pursuing these values that come along with capitalism, the idea of individuality, that you strive to get as much as you can. In fact, Miller said it at some point that what Willie represents is the person standing on top of his paid-for refrigerator with the deed for his house in his hand. And that's the highest form of happiness in a capitalist society. Rather than a society in which all of his neighbors had enough to eat and a decent place to live. See, that's not the value, the ideal of a capitalist society. Rather, it's the individual striving and achieving and maybe stepping on some other people on the way up. So I see the American dream as being that way of convincing us that we shouldn't get together with other people and take power and redistribute all the wealth in society so that there aren't people sleeping on the street right out there, which there are, right? Or people who are very hungry, or people who live three blocks from here who, because of where they live, happen to live 20 years less than the people who live 3 miles from here, north of here. Right? Happiness might be for us to redistribute wealth and power and opportunity so everyone has an equal chance to have a decent life. But that's not the American dream. The American dream is that I grab it for myself.
So, well, taking that notion, and we're going to turn the audience in here to see what your notions are, but taking that notion, if the original idea of the American dream was built on someone else not having a dream, was built on African people being enslaved on land that where genocide was committed against Native people so they could have plantations to enslave African people, if that's part of how the dream is built and what they meant by the dream so they could pursue their happiness, what does that say about pursuing happiness in the American dream? How does it get redefined? How does it get redefined on the levels, you know, from other communities' perspectives that are not white? And also, how does it get defined so that Willie Loman and the Willie Lomans, it can cross any racial line on the planet, I think, don't become depressed and kill themselves so their family can survive? Right. Which is, right? So, I mean, so how do we do that?
So there's this one piece that I wanted to add on to what Jeff was saying. There's this one part in the play where we see Willie going in to get the $50, right, from his neighbor. And he is almost in a psychotic state, like, or in some kind of other altered mental state, because he's literally not able to deal with the fact that he has to come down off of his refrigerator, right, in his isolation, his silo, and his little fiefdom to accept this $50, you know. And he's so... it's such a pressure on him mentally. And it's a big part of why he's trying to drive into things. Right. Which just really exacerbates this idea of individualism. Right. And so you look at every single one of our heroes, every single one of our mythical protagonists, from Jesus to Batman to, you know, to anyone, right? And there's this, I'm this self-made guy. I might have a sidekick, right? I might, right? But even there, there's going to be this tremendous power imbalance, right? And so, and yes, this is what, you know, America and the American dream is built off of. If you can achieve that, right? And everybody is pointed toward that in one way or another, right? Everybody is pointed toward that. And you see it in the guy, your neighbor, who's like always got the new hedge trimmer, you know, or the, you know, or he, you know, the, whatever, or the mom who's, oh, yes, we're going to, you know, ballet and we're, oh, I'm so busy because I'm running to this 5,000 things to take my kids to or whatever. And this is all part of what we have been forced to build by this, by the, you know, this other, right? And I mean, I think it's really masterful that we would craft this document, right, in 18th century, that would lead us to, you know, be sufficiently vague where we could say, you know, pursuit of happiness, right? And that would cause all of this, this thing to, you know, these things to follow like this and come one on top of the other, and then still be able to point and say, that's so noble. That was so great of them, right? But to get to your question about this idea of if the American dream is predicated on subjugation of somebody, right? Then is it valid? You know, can it possibly be valid? You know, I'll just give one little short anecdote. I have a house. I own my house, right? I own the land around my house. If some Native American tribe came to me and said, look, this part of Baltimore, it's proven here. You know, we have some perk tests. We dug up the ground. We, you know, we see the remains of my family here. And this is where this land was stolen. It belongs to us. And all of the empirical proof in the world and came to me and said, your house is sitting on my ancestry and my ancestors, right? I would have to say to them what? I would say, God, that's a tragedy. I fully empathize with you. You can't have my keys. You can't. You cannot have my keys, right? So I acknowledge, right, that an atrocity has been done to you. I fully acknowledge that, you know, that atrocity however many hundred years ago or decades maybe, right? Because it really hasn't been that long, y'all. But it has echoes, and those echoes are being felt today. What do you want me to do about it, right? That's why we have to keep having these conversations right here, because that's what the question is. So when it comes to, you know, race and American dream, yeah, the American dream is built off of completely racist, savagery, you know, or completely racist ideals, because somebody that looks like me wasn't included in that conversation and wasn't intended to be included in conversation, clearly. And it was justified. There were savage things that were done and are still being done, right, in an echo kind of way with inertia, right? And some of our careers, right, are still built on institutions that absolutely sanctioned and profited from that savagery, right?
So you all jump in. I mean, your thoughts on this. I have another question I want to put out about this as well, but I want to let you.
Sure. I mean, I guess to like the original question, I think in order to really authentically move forward with like everyone, we have to redefine like what happiness means. Like, if it just means like I'm successful and I do whatever I need to do to like have money and power and wealth and respect, and I step on everyone's next, like anyone's next to get it, if it's just about, if you're just thinking about yourself, or like your family or people who look like you, then that's fine. It'll work great for you. But you know, if you're really thinking about everyone, like every human as, your family, we're all human, humankind is one race. And when you start to think like that, it's really harder. You really can't just only worry about yourself. It's harder to like accept these systems that disadvantage, every difference, every racial minority, gender, I think, in order to move forward, we need to shift our ideals from being about just yourself, being individual, into looking at everyone.
So if we take that idea, Alethea, yeah. that we're hearing here, something else I was thinking about as you all were talking, is that this is big debates in the presidential campaign. People are watching about, you know, bring back America and put people back to work and all the rest, and arguing about the international treaties that were made and TPP and all the other things. One of the things that gets lost in this is the fact that one of the reasons Americans can't have the dream they have or they think they want to have is because now, even though there are a billion people who have nothing on the planet, there are now hundreds of millions of people on the planet because of globalization that are middle class in their worlds and wanting the same things as middle class people do here, whether they're in Lagos or whether they're in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, I mean to say, whatever they call it these days, but no matter where they are. So it means that fundamentally alters what's possible. How do you see that?
Yeah, I think in thinking about that, I think one interesting a community member told me once was, like, the deeper we go in conversation, the more universal it becomes. So he was meaning that the deeper we have connection with one another is where we find the human in ourselves. And but it's oftentimes we don't have time to do that, or we don't spend time to do that. That made me think a lot. And I think there's artist Pepona Nzario. He talks about how the global kind of begins from local. And so when local communities connect with each other and realize there is something common about the struggles that we have, and then from there this global conversation does happen, and we call that global. And yeah, and I definitely see it, like I was sharing, in terms of the idea of success in Korea. And I think for me, part of it, and moved my family to come to the U.S. So in thinking that it will help us to feel or to pursue our idea of happiness. And I think moving out of my country, there was a sense of freedom. I was free from the ways of Korea is. But it really makes you think, reflect, in terms of seeing my own country in a different lens. In terms of race, I think, like you shared, you living in America really makes you realize it is one way of seeing success. And especially my experience in the Asian community, we have this thing called the model minority myth. And like that, like there's, in Korea, there's a word, acronym called 엄친아, which is 엄마's 친구's 아들, and it means your mother's friend's son who's successful. And so those are the people who made it. And that makes everybody nervous about, oh, and depressed about my accomplishments, and you start comparing and compare. And I feel in terms of the Asian community and solidarity, or recognizing, seeing each other's struggle in a deeper level, I think those are great, important conversations that should continue to be done.
Solidarity. For those on the radio, there was just a fist bump between four of our guests. I'll leave the agency on that one. So a dream preferred is the title of this conversation, right? So in terms of the last question I asked, then how do we redefine that? I mean, how do we redefine, can we redefine, should we redefine what that dream means? What that dream of happiness, that American dream means. Sure. Jazia, go right ahead.
Yeah, and I think, one, yes, it should definitely be redefined. And, like, I think it should be, like, on one hand, more specific, and on the other hand, more vague. So, like, I mean, so yeah, let me explain.
Contradiction is existence. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think on the one hand, if we're really trying to move forward, I think we should take into account that we're all different. We all have differences, like, whether it be your age, your culture, where you live, what you want to do. And that's all cool. That's great. So taking that into account, we have to realize that there's no set standard way that people can move through the world. You know, you have to, like by definition, like, we're all different people, so our experiences and lives are going to be different. And that's great. So in that sense, I think, I don't know, I guess, like, it should be vague in that it doesn't, like, there's not, like, we don't think of it as one way that you gain success or that you find happiness or accomplishment. But, I kind of lost my train of thought. But I guess in being more specific, I think just, like, explicitly saying, it's okay to be different. Your differences and, like, your experience, your life experience is valid. I guess, yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense. And so Jeff, you know, when you think about what Lethia and Jazia was just saying, that many cultures on the planet do believe in happiness, that happiness can exist. But it's redefining it. We all want that security. You worked for years when people were homeless. People want a home. People want a shelter. People want a place to be, to exist in community. So how do we begin? Can we really redefine what the dream is?
Oh, yeah, sure. We can, but we have to do it together. We can't do it by ourselves. There's a symmetry between how we get to where we're going and where we're going, right? So by, in a democratic, participatory way, reorganizing society and making sure there's a place for all of us in it, that's how we redefine happiness. I can't redefine it for all of us, but I'm pretty certain that we need to do it together. There's so much inequality. You know, we've reached a new level of inequality in the United States. We are more unequal than any society in the history of advanced industrial societies. We're unequal according to race and class and health. I mentioned life expectancy. Every disease you can imagine is more prevalent among poor people than among rich people. So people are condemned to being sick and dying younger simply because of their race and their class and their gender. We don't have to live in that kind of society. We don't have to produce according to the profitability of some enterprise. We could produce according to what everybody needs. Imagine, this is the wealthiest country in the history of history. And yet, tonight, at least 5,000 of our neighbors are going to be sleeping on the street. We don't know how many, but at least 5,000. There's no reason for that. There's something like 42,000 vacant houses in Baltimore. There's probably 5,000 vacant hotel rooms tonight. In fact, the city, we own the hotel that's just right down the street here, the Hilton. We own it. But I can't walk up there with a guy I find on the street who has nowhere to stay tonight and say, you know, I think room 307 ought to be a fine place for him or her to stay tonight, even though we own it. So we can change those means. Of course, we can create a new definition of happiness, but we have to do it together, and we have to do it in a collaborative, participatory way.
I think we've proven that every boundary, be it gender, race, economic, is pretty unimportant to worth of a human, right? And I think that in all the 5,000 homeless people, you're going to find some happy guys out there, even though they're homeless, right? which indicates to us that home, that happiness is a choice, right? And happiness is set by that individual. And so when we start to figure that out and we start to allow people to be happy, like, let this guy be happy, because he's, you know, don't poo-poo on his, you know, my son, you know, he saw a guy, he was obviously 40s or something, and he was at McDonald's at the takeout, you know, may I take your order? And when we got in the car, my son had some remark, you know, based on his privilege, right? About that guy was old. Why was he there? You know, he should, shouldn't he be doing something better? Basically, it was how his remark was. And I said, you have no idea who that guy is or what his story is. You know, it could be that last year something horrible was happening, you know, in his life or whatever. So, but at the end of the day, that, did he serve your food well? Did he seem to have good manners and what have you? Yeah, he did. That's why I'm saying he should have been doing something else. Like, you know, and I said, but, you know, he seemed happy. That guy seemed happy. And happiness, if he has it, makes him richer than the next guy that he, whose food he was serving to, who was miserable because they may have been miserable because they had to come to McDonald's because couldn't afford anything but the dollar menu, you know? So when we figure out how to work as a unit, you know, as a group, and when we figure out how to let people be happy with who they are and where they are and let Biff go off into the and be in the dirt and be okay with it, then we'll start moving forward as a nation.
I want to thank Alethea Hoon-Jin Shin, Brother Changa Nyong'o, Jeff Singer, and Jajia Floyd at the Everyman Theater. Death of a Salesman will be playing at Everyman along with Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire until June the 12th. More information at everymantheater.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. For your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Have a great weekend. Take care.